FNR, Football Nation Radio. The Journos, with Carlos Alberto Diego and Jonathan Howcroft from The Guardian Australia on FNR, Football Nation Radio.
Welcome everyone, streaming football 24-7. It's FNR, Football Nation Radio, Australia's first and only 24-hour radio station dedicated to the beautiful game of football. I'm Carlos Alberto Diego, and this is the Journos Wednesday edition, and we all know what that means. It's Jonathan Howcroft from the Guardian Australia joining us this morning. Good morning to you, Jonathan.
Good morning, Carlos.
It's so good seeing you. There's a beautiful day out there, and I'm sure all throughout Australia, it's a beautiful day. And, of course, it's a beautiful day because we're talking football too. The big issue, of course, has been rumbling. You've been covering it so, so well, and a lot of people out there have realise that you are almost the foremost, a reporter on the Congress and where we are with it at the moment. Of course, Ray Gatt wrote an article this morning, which I'm not across yet, but you had a look at. Gives a little bit of a progression to where we were last week with the Congress.
Yeah, absolutely. So where we were before today was that at the back end of last week, FIFA passed their judgment on the state of Australian football, and their recommendation wasn't the end of days normalisation committee. It was to come in with a Congress review working group. And the idea behind that, rather than my interpretation of it, was rather than saying, okay, where we are now, which is 9-1, is the anchor to where we should go. Instead, let's start with a blank sheet of paper and say, after consultation with all of the stakeholders within Australian football, what does the ideal model look like? And then let's aim to creating that.
So is that with the view that suddenly, when the FFA were suggesting a model, they had clubs in mind, they had the PFA in mind, and they had a women's vote in mind. But what we've had in the last 6 to 12 months is the AAFC come on board. We've got coaches associations. We've had referees. We've had futsal. We've had all these groups saying, hey, I want a voice too. So suddenly, totally. I think it's really for FIFA, it's actually quite a smart and intelligent way of going about it. Blank sheet. Let's have a look at all the interest groups in Australia. Let's see whether we can give them a voice.
Agree 100%. Yeah. And from FIFA's point of view, this is what the Congress should always have looked like. Mm. This is when they refer to Statute 15J about a Congress that is reflective of representative democracy. This is what that representative democracy looks like, because football is a broad church and 9 member federations and 1 A-League representative is not. Mm. So from my perspective all along is that completely fanciful rainbow coalition is what you actually want to end up with, because that forces compromise, it forces negotiation, it eliminates the possibility of a single interest voting bloc. The how that actually works in practice will be very difficult, because it'd be like herding cats if you get
But other countries, is it the English FA that we're talking about? I mean, they have 60 or 70 stakeholders at the table? Is that right?
Don't quote me on it. I think it's over 100. I think it's 120 or something.
And really, I mean, people complain about, the other way that the English might not win World Cups and stuff, but they run their game pretty well.
Yeah, but that is actually a good example of herding cats. Yeah, okay. So the people that are actually involved in the day-to-day operation of the FA Council it probably wouldn't be their preferred model, but it is a working model and it is a more democratic model. And while we're at day zero, if you like, in this process, I think we should be optimistic and we should look to create the best system rather than be anchored to where we've started from and use that as the basis for everything that follows. So that all happened last Thursday, which brought quite a lot of optimism, a lot of cautious optimism. I was definitely optimistic. My reaction column was optimistic, and very quickly, it became apparent that there may have been some misplaced optimism in that. So what was noticeable was the very first piece of communication about this was the FFA's press release. And that came out before it came out with wording that implied the FFA were going to lead the Congress Review Working Group with support from FIFA. The clubs were outraged by that suggestion, and they put out their response, which used direct reference to the language that FIFA used in the letter, which indicates that FIFA is leading the Congress Review Working Group. The FIFA letter was then circulated. It was released, which supports the club's position and questions the language used in the FFA media release. And then immediately you're thinking, well, clearly there's a disconnect. The FFA have released their press release and put their language in to set the anchor point for the conversation. Very quickly, it felt like that was undermined. But then the following morning, the Friday morning, the FFA then released another media release without any of their own editorial, which is just a reference to the public statement put out by FIFA. Mm. So the letter that was in circulation was a private letter signed by Zvonimir Boban, which for me is just the most outstanding part of this whole process. So the letter from Zvonimir Boban uses language different to the official media release on the FIFA website, which is a lot more collegiate, indicating that the process will be an FFA, FIFA, AFC process, whereas the letter indicates that it will be a FIFA process. So once you get into that space, you're then guessing about what negotiations are taking place, what lobbying has happened. Are we making too much of what's basically just an issue of wording, or does that represent something much more significant? And what has happened in the last couple of days is the FFA has begun the process of communicating what this Congress Review Working Group will look like, and the clubs have just flat out refused to deal with the FFA based on the terms of what the FFA have put out. Going back to that original conversation about language, implying that the FFA's stake in this process is greater than we initially expected on when FIFA's judgment came out on the Thursday. The clubs are refusing to deal with Stephen Lowy. It's just as simple as that. They refer back to the August delegation visit of FIFA AFC, and in their opinion, how obstructionist Stephen Lowy was during that process. And they don't want to see a repeat of that. They believed that they were close to a consensus during that time with the member federations within the current 9-1 model to expand that to a different model, which would be based on an A-League independent operating model, and then they would reduce their votes in Congress as a consequence. They believed that they were close to that getting up. And then, in their opinion, direct intervention from Stephen Lowy prevented that from becoming a reality. So they're very fearful that the same is going to happen again. So they want the terms of reference of this Congress Working Group to be set by FIFA and for FFA to reduce its role as a stakeholder in this conversation.
But they're not, by definition, a stakeholder. The board is voted in by the stakeholders. This is how I understood it whenever this started 12 months ago. From that day, this was a gripe of the clubs.
Yes.
That the FFA seem to be driving everything, but they're the ones who are actually, the board's voted in by the makeup of the Congress, so those stakeholders, and they felt that they should just be almost just observers to the whole thing. They shouldn't have an active influence in it. So the question I ask you, Jonathan, is why do the FFA feel that they've got to lead the way here? A lot of people out there will be, they have a lot of mistrust about why they might do it. But is there another reason why, a good reason why they might want to take this as part of their responsibility?
Well, the response in the past is that they, as the board of the company, of FFA, they have a responsibility to steward the governance process. And that seems to be a perfectly legitimate argument. And
is that because of corporate law in Australia?
That's yep. It's all underpinned by that. Yeah. So everything that they've done, that they've executed, has been based on an understanding of that, and operating in the timelines and the executing their duties as the elected officers. So from that respect, it doesn't seem unreasonable. The difficulty is that as both a steward and an active participant, there's clearly a grey area. And in this instance, it felt like that what FIFA had done was decongested that situation by sidelining FFA's leadership as the mediator, so that they could retain their role as a voice in the conversation, but not as the voice managing the entire process. And this is why the review working group's terms of reference are so relevant, because it's about the questions that they ask. It's about the stakeholders that they see. It's about the timelines that are set. Say, for example, you're the nascent fans association, which is in the process of being formed and getting a voice and gaining legitimacy. Say the timeline is a month for a resolution. That's not going to be long enough for a group like that to get into to a level of maturity to get a seat on the Congress. Say it's a 6 month to 12 month process, then they become they have a greater likelihood of getting a voice in the conversation. It may not manifest as a seat immediately, but it could emerge into one. So there are lots of political details involved that are very relevant to the ultimate outcome, and the clubs are threatening to not take part in this process because they have no faith in the outcome if the terms of reference are set by the FFA and the process is managed by the FFA rather than FIFA.
It seems like, though, in the more recent correspondence by Zvonimir Boban, that maybe FIFA's softening on the idea that FFA should just be observing this rather than being part of it, given that it's an FFA / FIFA / AFC type progression forward. What happens, though, if FIFA say, no, we understand the position FFA is in because of corporate law in Australia. We want them to be having more responsibility in this, which means they might have to, you know, guide this process a little bit. What happens if the clubs turn around and say, no, we don't accept that? And FIFA's saying, no, well, this is how it's going to be.
Great question. We don't know. I mean, the nuclear option at both ends of this have been, we've pushed the margins of them without actually finding out what the worst case scenario could be. And I think the clubs are now being pushed into that situation. They would hope that their stance will force FIFA to take greater control of this situation and potentially derail the situation and force FIFA's hand to introduce a normalisation committee, which would definitely benefit the clubs in that situation. But one of the biggest factor in all of this that we have very little understanding of is FIFA's philosophical position in this. I would have presumed that 2 years was long enough for FFA to be given to put the house in order. So when November 30 came around, it just seemed to stand to reason that if you're going to put a deadline in, you're going to honour it by imposing punitive measures, which in this case would have been a normalisation committee. So for mediation to be anything other than FIFA controlled would seem very unsatisfying to me. And again, as we've seen throughout this whole process, it's very difficult to believe that the FFA would enter into this process as leaders without anything other than their preferred outcome, working towards their preferred outcome. Whereas if FIFA come in with a blank sheet of paper and say, what should the future look like? Great. Whereas if it's the FFA saying, okay, we're beginning with 9-1. Yeah. These are the rules that we've got to follow. We think we should get to here. Come on, guys, let's all get together and do it for the best interest of the game. That would be, I would be disappointed with that outcome.
What I understand, Jonathan, is that 4 months ago, 5 months ago, when they all got together and FIFA and, you know, the delegation from FIFA joined the AFC and they came to Australia and they were here for the whole week. And it was the week where, of course, the clubs thought they'd, you know, negotiated something with the other stakeholders. And then Stephen Lowy, you know, almost forced a backflip on two occasions during that week. Well, FIFA and a delegation of FIFA and AFC were here that week.
Yeah.
So what the hell were they doing here? I mean, and aren't we going back to that moment again? Shouldn't that have all happened back then?
So last Thursday when FIFA's letter came out, the fear was that anything other than normalisation would just be that, would just be more of the same. But the language in that letter indicated that they were taking over in all but name. Now, after the rewording of the public release on Friday and then this communication between the clubs and FFA, there is a fear that that's all we're going to get again. More talking around the issue without getting anywhere near a resolution. And if that is the case, that would be a poor outcome, I think.
It's deeply unsatisfying for me. And I'm not talking about me backing the clubs because I know they've, you know, you question their interests here too. And not that it's an interest that no one knows about or it's a hidden interest. Clubs are in it. Their core business is to win games, build their brand and not worry so much for game development. They could say that, but I've spoken to CEOs of clubs and they'll openly say that it's not about game development for us. It's about growing the game. We hope the trickle-down effect, almost the Trump-type trickle-down effect, will affect the rest of the game.
Well, it's about building a bigger pie.
Absolutely, and that's how they feel that they can help the game. But that, of course, that can go, you know, horribly wrong too. So it's not that I'm backing the clubs. I'm backing democracy here and everyone having a say. I don't care how big this Congress is, and it'd be deeply unsatisfying if we've start with a parameter of you know, something that's built around a parameter of you know, a structure, rather than that blank page that you talk about. That blank page, suddenly we go back to square one. We need to ask a heap of questions, and I think you asked this a number of weeks ago. What do we want our A-League to be?
Totally.
That's the first question. It really became abundantly clear once you mentioned that a couple of weeks ago. And me talking to John Dillitzo on a weekly basis, it just means that it's really become clear to me that we need to go back. And we've come a long way, by the way. We're not a basket case. This is not a basket. We're actually gone a long way. We've got an industry now. But one big whiteboard, right? And we've got the big questions to ask. What do we want the A-League to be? What do we want, you know, the NPL to be? Do we want a second division? All that stuff comes from what do we want the A-League to be? And I think the fact that, you know, that question can be answered by multiple and a range of stakeholders, I think suddenly we get all these different insights about what the A-League can be.
100%.
And suddenly everyone buys into it. It's just not clubs, what the clubs think the A-League should be. It's what the whole sport thinks the A-League should be.
And moreover, it just seems to stand to reason that the best facilitators for that process would be FIFA, because they have the clearest understanding of the minimum requirements. They have a broad understanding of what works elsewhere in the world, and they can shape that conversation, knowing what best practice looks like for the best outcomes of Australia, rather than being moderated by FFA, which clearly has skin in the game and will be reluctant to, one would imagine, would be reluctant to deviate very far from the existing model based on the evidence of the past 2 years, which has led us, you know, into this dreadful situation.
Jonathan, let's take a break. I mean, thanks for the update, by the way. You know, I thought that we'd have to just wait now and you'd be smooth sailing.
I thought
damn Ray Gatt, damn him from the Australian. If you're listening, Ray, he's throwing this out in the mix. And we thought now it's going to be smooth sailing. So we all sorted out, but it looks like there's still a little bit of angst involved in the process. But let's take a break. I want to come back and talk a little bit about the A-League and some of the things that maybe this whole process is suddenly led the FFA to maybe give up a few things, like the possibility that there could be loan agreements in January. It's 4 weeks ago, 4 weeks away, and we haven't even had a chance to even discuss this, but it looks like it might be something the clubs might want, and suddenly they might give them that. So it's amazing how quickly they can move if they need to. But there's a couple of other things we can talk about in the A-League. This is The Journos with Jonathan Howcroft from The Guardian Australia here on FNR Football Nation Radio. More after the break.
FNR. Football Nation Radio. The Journos with Carlos Alberto Diego and Jonathan Howcroft from The Guardian Australia on FNR Football Nation Radio.
Streaming football 24/7, this is FNR Football Nation Radio, Australia's first and only 24-hour radio station dedicated to the beautiful game of football. I'm Carlos Alberto Diego, and the man that's really showing the sketches of the beautiful game today in the journos, it's Wednesday edition with Jonathan Howcroft from The Guardian Australia. Sometimes when we talk about the Congress, Jonathan, I'm not quite sure whether I should start the every segment with this whole thing about being the beautiful game, but it is a beautiful game because beauty can also come from angst and argument and debate and not enmity so much, but a little bit of bitterness in there too can lead to some beauty,
absolutely,
I think.
Absolutely, absolutely it can. And we need to embrace it. We need to not be fearful of it. We need to take it head on and do it with ambition and confidence and look to the other side. Mm. When you're in it, clearly it's a mess, but hopefully it's the stepping stone to brighter things.
Absolutely, and it's amazing how all the news was around Timmy Cahill leaving Melbourne City and why he's left, and you know all these question marks about how could City let a star like that leave, and you know where is he going next? So suddenly, one kid, Nathaniel Atkinson, plays his first game on the weekend, and suddenly Timmy Cahill's forgotten. Not because he's a better player than Timmy, but the focus is on the next gen.
Yeah.
This terrific performance by this boy from Tasmania, and mate, while I was watching this guy play, I'm thinking, if they've plucked him from Tasmania by accident, according to John Didlitzer, who was a football manager there when he joined, how many more of these Nathaniel Atkinsons are there around Australia?
Dozens.
Jonathan?
Dozens. You've got to presume that there are stacks of them. And one of the great challenges of this post-Congress situation is figuring out the best way of identifying them and then polishing the diamonds. There are so many examples of raw talent that just needs harnessing in the right way, and we don't necessarily yet have the right system to fast track that raw talent into a polished professional footballer. And you look this season at the success of some of the former NPL players, who, like Nikola Miljusnic, is for me the best example right now. You just look at him and think, you have got so much raw talent, the pace, the natural trickery, but his decision-making has let him down. Mm. He should have 10 goals probably this season already and double that number of assists. And he's just one of those players that you can see improving every time he steps out on the pitch, because that exposure is so significant. We've seen it with a couple of guys at Perth Glory. Mm. And you know that it's there bubbling under as well in that National Youth League system, of which Nathaniel Atkinson is a great example. And as the conversation has been for this week so far, it just shows how much more opportunity these kids need. And as much as it makes sense for Melbourne City, as the example in this case, to have an incredibly strong youth setup. Mm. They're investing in it. They've got great facilities, and clearly you can see the business model behind what they're doing. You just need to see them play. They need exposure. The PFA are pulling out reams and reams of data, which shows the decline in the amount of playing minutes from young Australian players, the opportunities that have been denied. You've got 5 visa spots on an A-League roster that are almost inevitably going to get taken up. The system is just not designed at the moment to benefit the likes of Nathaniel Atkinson. And as supporters, there's nothing more exciting than watching a young player come through and take an opportunity like he did. We saw it with Christian Theoharis at Melbourne Victory a few weeks ago, and he's not been cited as much as we might have hoped. Jacob Italiano at Perth Glory is a good example of backing youth in Kenny Lowe's sense. And there are other, you know, one or two examples around the competition, but it's not the norm. And the amount of excitement that those young players bring and the promise of what they're going to deliver in the future, to me, should be a core component of the competition. And it's not. It's just a bit of frippery around the margins. And within this process that we're going through, that has to be front and center. The Herald Sun, and I'm sure it was syndicated around the country, canvassed the coaches at the start of the season and asked them some questions about what improvements they would make to the A-League. And all of them were concerned about the lack of opportunity for young players. And it was Graham Arnold said that there were 7 or 8 of his squad who should be playing first team football. You look at Melbourne City, we've not seen Daniel Arzani or Ruan Tongyik.
And the first time I heard about Daniel Arzani was Tim Cahill talking about him when he first joined the club, saying that this guy at training takes on experienced players for fun. And that was two years ago. And it may have been before Tim Cahill. I think I heard about him before that, but Tim actually reinforced it in an interview. Now, if this kid's been at this club for 3 years, taking senior players on for fun with arrogance at training and showing every bit as much as any of them at training, I think I've seen him once play against Central Coast Mariners in Gosford. And when he came on, he turned the game, by the way. So the concern for me is, you know, everyone's bemoaned the fact that, oh, where's the next golden generation? We'd have the golden generation, all this sort of stuff, right? But if we, and Ange Postecoglou sort of righted that a little bit in that when he came in, he says, I'm going to scour the world for any Aussies that can play for Australia, maybe can play for another country, but playing in different leagues. I'm going to go find these guys. I'm going to talk to them. Gianni was one of them, for example. He's actually turned, Jackson Irvine could have played for Scotland. Jamie McLaren could have played for Scotland. Those guys are playing for Australia, I think, because of the approach of Ange Postecoglou. So why aren't we doing that in Australia? I mean, we're scouring the world for these guys over there, and I understand why, because if you're over there, you're probably elite. If you were in Australia, you'd be elite and obviously going there for a bit more opportunity. But in Australia, from what I'm seeing from these young kids coming through, the good ones, I mean, there's always ones who are talented but don't have it to get further. But we're already seeing sprinkling of them in A-League, and we don't even have a talent ID system that farms them out everywhere. It sort of goes looking for them everywhere. Ron Smith, who is actually on our School of Football show, our winning coach show with Chris Appleford. And you listen to that guy speak, and I don't know how he's not working in Australian football. You know, how he's not in charge of, you know, these great coaches of the past who were part of the AIS, who were part of junior development, who structured up all our programs pre-curriculum, before the Dutch came in. Mate, I'd have a committee of those guys, and your job is to go and find the best Indigenous footballer that's playing in a remote part of Australia. Go and find, just go to all these places, and that's your job. And just tell us what you think. Surely we have former Socceroos that could be great talent ID people, former coaches that aren't doing much now. In fact, they've been ostracised by the sport. I'm just driving around on the weekend listening to a replay of Ron Smith on the Winning Coach show, and I'm thinking, my God, why aren't we using this guy?
Yeah, I agree 100%. And the example of Nathaniel Atkinson in isolation just gives credence to the need to have significant football properties in as many parts of the country as possible. He's a Tasmanian who's performing in the A-League, or has just started to perform in the A-League, and there isn't an A-League property in Tasmania. So it just seems to stand to reason that's one of the things that you would look to. Clearly, everything has to be budgeted, but that's one of the ambitions that you would want to aim towards, whether it's a partnership. You look at how the AFL does it. They also don't have their own team on Tasmania, but they've done it in such a way as that market has been captured by the two teams that go there, one north, one south. We need to be exploring those kind of options and capitalizing on those kinds of markets. And not just Tasmania. Tasmania is a great example, but all over the country.
Mm.
And it just feels like there's a missed opportunity or a decade's worth of missed opportunities because we're not aligned in the right way. And you know, as we've said throughout this whole process, we should now be looking at this as the realignment opportunity, as the ambition moment, as the, okay, we've had 15 years of stability. Now we can use that as a springboard. Mm. And these are the gaps in the market that realignment can benefit.
The other thing also is the idea that I think it's funny how the FFA, under a bit of pressure, can suddenly relent on some things. And we were already hearing, there was an article in the Herald Sun the other day, I think it was Dave Davidovich who wrote it, the idea that the FFA may be allowing clubs to loan out players to each other during January, which is only a couple of weeks away, right? I'm just thinking, where did this come from, right? If this has been on the drawing board, I apologise to people at the FFA. And if clubs and the PFA and FFA have been talking about this for a while, I apologise. But this has come out of the blue for me. And is it a reaction to the fact that clubs want a little bit more autonomy? They want to be heard a little bit more. And maybe this is a little bit of, a little bit of incentive for them to play ball with the FFA. I don't know. But that's one thing that I kind of like. If clubs want that, and I think that gives an opportunity to some of the players, like Azani, to go off to another club where they've got a bit of a gap and they'll get more game time, but he's still a Melbourne City player. Why not spread it even further and say have relationships with clubs all around Asia? The Malaysian leagues are quite a good league. I mean, Andrew Nabu went over there and changed his football life. And there's a couple of Aussies that have gone over there and actually played in a really good standard. But I'm sure there's some Malaysian clubs, even if it's second division, where you're sending a Nazani there or Nathaniel Atkinson if he's not getting regular game time, or a Tonjic, you know, these sort of guys, Ruan Tonjic, get them over playing second division in Malaysia. At least they're playing senior football in a different environment. You're progressing their development. And if they're ready, they'll play first team football here. But don't sit them in youth teams where there's eight games. The youth league's got eight games, for heaven's sake. I mean, really. And we don't have big enough squads for these guys to really have a realistic chance of playing first team football, because it's not, you know, they're just not picked in. It's 23 man squads, you know. I don't know. It just seems the structure's wrong. But if we can give them more opportunity by being creative thinkers, maybe that's the way to go.
Yeah, I absolutely. I would need a bit more convincing on loaning players out to Malaysia.
Yep.
But I'm happy to be convinced on that. But there are clearly a number of areas that we can address to begin with. Again, going back to what the coaches themselves talked about, why limit the substitutes bench? Why couldn't you have theoretically an unlimited subs bench? So you're in a situation where you're 2-0 up and cruising. On your bench, you've got your former senior outfield players to pick from because that's your best squad. But there's no real benefit in bringing on a senior player at that moment. You're actually going to get a lot more from exposing one of your youth team players at that situation. So that to me, it's those kinds of issues. And they are league operational issues, similar to the loan system. So these don't need to be whole of football solutions. These can just be operational management issues. And as you suggested off the top, it wouldn't be, I don't think it would be unfair to draw the conclusion that you came to, that there are marginal gains to be had at this time, because the FFA, it will be looking to present itself as more open and responsive to the needs of the clubs and the players at this time. But that doesn't mean to say that we can't benefit as a consequence. Sometimes motives aren't, it doesn't matter if the motives aren't pure, if the outcome is what you want to begin with.
But you'd love it to be part of a big plan.
Of course.
Rather than just, let's just give them that, just to shut them up for a while. That's the feeling I get, and I could be completely wrong. But looking from outside in, that's what I feel like that's happened here. Johnson, let's take another break. And when we come back, I want to ask you about the type of CEO that Melbourne Victory, our biggest club in Australia, needs going forward? I know it's a question without notice, but I just want you to have a think about it over the next couple of minutes over the break here on The Journos with Jonathan Howcroft from The Guardian Australia here on FNR Football Nation Radio.
FNR Football Nation Radio. The Journos with Carlos Alberto Diego and Jonathan Howcroft from The Guardian Australia on FNR Football Nation Radio.
24/7. This is FNR Football Nation Radio. It is The Journos with Jonathan Howcroft from The Guardian Australia. Now, Jonathan, it was a question without notice before the break, but I know you're a quick-thinking guy. You've got yourself 3 minutes over the promo break there. CEO Ian Robson, of course, has resigned from the job there at Melbourne City. Did what he needed to do over a four-year span while he was there. I mean, they won trophies and, look, I don't know what the KPI is there, but I think he seemed to have done a reasonable job. I think, personally, I think there are around about 27,000 members there at Melbourne Victory, around that mark. I think they should already be a 40,000-member club. But I understand also the restrictions and the parameters that they've needed to work around since day one with the way that the A-League's run and the centralised sort of approach by the FFA. Does it matter who they get?
You've stolen my thunder a little bit. In everything that you just explained would be how I would have framed my answer to say, I'm not actually sure it's that significant an appointment considering all of the constraints that a club sits in within the A-League and the FFA pyramid. So clearly you want a good administrator, but I'm not sure it necessarily needs to be eye-catching, especially at Victory because of the public presence of Anthony Di Pietro. I think that dynamic works really well with Di Pietro being the front of the organisation, the person. His annual speech at the Victory season launch is always a scene setter for the season, and he uses it incredibly astutely as a political tool. And within this negotiating process from the clubs to the FFA, he's a central figure in it. He is a sizable political character, and I think it then complements it for the CEO to keep everything ticking over rather than being a public facing individual. So I think while we're still in the situation that we are, I think you have to just accept the reality for what it is. But if in 12-18 months where we are in a situation where we're talking about an independent A-League, then you're moving into a different conversation, because that should create the opportunity for somebody to really exploit the new terms of reference and start to. If there will be space at that moment for an innovative, ambitious club executive to really take their club leaps and bounds forward once the shackles are removed, if they are able to secure the right corporate partners, and if they are able to secure the right stadia deals, and if they are able to get the right balance of ticket pricing and atmosphere and club performance, you could really see one or two of these just explode from their current situations.
Could we be doing it better, though? I mean, you talk about Anthony Di Pietro. I'm not around, obviously, what happens on a day-to-day basis in other states and territories around A-League clubs. It just doesn't seem that the owners or the chairman are as public in the media. And I mean, we do obviously see Anthony Di Pietro at, you know, their Victory in Business. He does a terrific speech, usually something that's hitting the nail on the head with regards to what the issues in the game are at that time from the club's perspective. And that gets widely reported, but it only happens once or twice a year. I always think back, and I don't want to compare us to other sports, but I will on this point. Eddie Maguire is just such a public face of the Collingwood Football Club in the AFL. And whether you love him or hate him, he's out there fighting for his club the whole time. And he's pointing fingers, he's fighting, he's defending, he's, you know, Anthony Di Pietro's got that in him. Should he be doing more of that? And not only him, but should chairmen of other A-League clubs be doing more of that in their markets?
My own personal opinion is no. I think Victory is a very well-run club that up until the start of this season, has performed extremely well on the field. So there isn't the need to justify decisions. Mm. The club works. And when it's working, just let them get on with it. If you look around the country, the case studies are so specific. You've got Tony Sage at Perth Glory. Mm. And then his counterbalance is Peter Philopoulos, which seems to make extremely good sense, that in Peter you've got someone who's a skilled football administrator. He can talk well. He gets football.
He's on social media regularly.
Terrific on social media. Mm. And engages with everybody in all of the pertinent conversations. And then you go north and you've got someone like Mike Charlesworth at Central Coast, who just isn't going to be that that hands-on owner in the same way that's going to directly engage. So it's up to his executives to take on that responsibility, same as the Bakeries at Brisbane Roar. Mm. Melbourne City, again, it's going to be the executives, not the owners, who are necessarily going to be front and
center.
But
we're not seeing Scott Munn. I've not seen Scott. Is he lost? Is he in the corridors there at Melbourne? It doesn't do anything publicly. Now, I don't know if that's part of the strategy there at Melbourne City, but I think it's a mistake. Scott was good in the media when he was doing a lot of it, but it's been really clear that he's either been told not to or he's just not choosing to. Which I just want people to speak on behalf of their clubs. It's not players only, because players are hamstrung too about what they say. Coaches are also. So you get the playing side of it. Sometimes, you know, it's pretty much, you know, banal sort of stuff. But when a spokesman for the club, and I'm not talking about coach right now, I'm talking about owner, chairman, these sort of people, they can speak more freely about what the issues are and with real confidence that they're speaking on behalf of their club and in line with their branding, in line with their message. I just reckon supporters would love to hear more of that. I don't know. I just reckon we don't do it enough in football.
Yeah, you might be right. I'm trying to go through in my head the different examples. Because you started with Victory, and because there is a gap for a chief executive there, they're the example that you started with. And I don't think that there's a need for it. That may not be the case. You may be right that there needs to be more engagement, full stop, and there may need to be more specific engagement around the country. But I think in Victory's case, it's working.
Yeah, you know, I suppose it's talking more to the supporters. Victory supporters are really. I've grown up with football all my life in Australia, and until Victory came along, I had in my mind a profile of an Australian football supporter in Australia. When I say football, soccer supporter, right? But when Victory came along, I really saw this a different type of supporter come along, really intelligent, deep thinking type supporter that had high expectations for their club. It was almost like the AFL fan expectation of their AFL club that's now coming into football here in Australia. It'd probably be probably not so different to what you'd get over in England. This feeling that I own this club, people who are running it are just transient, players are just transient, but I own this club, so you better do a good job. And if you're not up to it, you don't love this club, get out. There was this whole feeling that I own the club. And so there's real demand and expectation. People want to be spoken to, and not by those messages that are thrown out by coaches and players, because I don't blame them. It's just I don't want to do anything that's off message for the club. But that's where the chairman and owners come in, and it's not so much to build, you know, bigger membership or promote the club. It's really just speaking to the supporters, and answering their questions through the issues that they've learnt about. I don't think we do that enough. That's all.
Mm. I wouldn't challenge your perception. What would be great is if we had a football supporters organisation that canvassed these kind of opinions on a large scale and actually had a voice in the conversation. Which is
another one in the Congress, seat at the Congress.
It's in the pipeline. Yeah. So,
so you're hearing something?
Oh no, it is. There is a group of A-League supporters who are Australian football supporters who are coalescing with a view to forming a fans federation, as there are overseas, with the ultimate goal of gaining a seat on Congress, which to me just seems to stand to reason.
Jonathan, can the Wednesday Journos get a seat on Congress? I think can we put some sort of... I'm just thinking... Oh, by the way, I'm not denigrating at all that, but I think it's fantastic. But I'll tell you what, where does it end? I mean, does media have something on Congress? I mean, our media in Australia often has almost fuelled... those issues that actually lead to a progression in the sport.
So this is a conversation that you've had with John Dalitzer, and he speaks about very openly that there's a tension between engagement and advocacy and actually doing your job properly. So it seems to stand to reason that the PFA should have a voice on the Congress, but it may then actually come into conflict with their core business. Mm. And I think the same with the media in that respect, whereas fans, they're a stakeholder. They're a key stakeholder underpinning everything. You take the fans away, you remove all of the financial model of football. It wouldn't just exist in a bubble to as and of itself. It exists because there's a demand for it, and there are sponsors that want to get associated with the community that ultimately will feed into their businesses. So... where the media sits in that, I think it's comfortable sitting on the outside.
Yeah, it is, actually. You just convinced me. We don't need to have the media on the board.
It'd be great to be in the meetings.
Yeah, absolutely. Can we stick in some sort of a hidden mic somewhere or a hidden camera? That'd be fantastic. But, Jonathan, it's been a pleasure again, mate. Time's gone by a whole hour and had a really great discussion. Thanks for bringing us up to speed with all the Congress stuff on the back of Ray Gatt's Australian article today. But we'll speak to Ray on that on Friday. But thanks for joining us today,
thanks,
mate.
Good
on you. That's Jonathan Howcroft here from the Garden Australia. Of course, that is the end of the Journo's Wednesday edition. You can podcast the show on iTunes and SoundCloud.com. So until tomorrow when we speak to Maddie Winley of the Herald Sun, may you have a great day in football.
The Journo on FNR, Football Nation Radio.